Chapter 22 of When Thief Meets Thief by Harry Stephen Keeler. Wanted, one driver. Well, here I was, back in America, ready to spring my trap on Tillery. I had the skull representing the centermost feature of the proposed ad for his forthcoming book. I had Grandfather's duplicate certified manuscript of that very book, and Grandfather's will, and all of Sam's letters to me, of course. And all I needed now was Laughing Sam to back up some of the points in my story, and a good firm of lawyers. That, and to get to El Paso. For my money was gone. Passage for the princess and myself on the Ning Hua had taken all but about $5. But even while I was watching the lights of that streetcar vanishing in the far distance, a battered Buick coupe drew up to the street lamp under which I stood. A man with a cap, the peak low over his eyes, was driving it clumsily with his left hand, for his right hand was bandaged. "Can you tell me," he asked, "if this road goes to the main highway that leads to New Orleans?" "No," I replied. "I wish I could, and I wish to heaven, furthermore, that I was on it." "Why, you going to New Orleans?" he asked. "No, El Paso, which is on the way, I take it." He regarded me shrewdly. The tilting upward of his head as he did so showed that he was in the early middle age, with penetrating gray eyes and a firm chin. "Say, can you drive?" "I'll say I can." "Want to drive me as far as El Paso? This mitt of mine is on the bum, and it's hell for me. 2, maybe 3 days rest for it, and I can do my own driving." "God, yes. I want to get hold of a chap there, and then start a lawsuit. I'll drive you, gladly." "I like," he warned me, "to camp out at night. I hate people, hotels, tourist camps. If that's all okay with you, then come along." It was. I hopped in with my 2 pieces of luggage and thus began a trip to El Paso, only 1,200 miles, that was to last 4 full days. That the fellow was plainly on the run, I knew within 30 minutes, and that it was a murder rap at that. As good as I knew after we'd been together 24 hours. As for the 4 days the trip had to take us, the machine had a bad front axle that slowed it up, and it looked and worked like something he'd desperately been provided with just as John Law had tried to close in on him. He never, however, at any time during the course of the trip told me who he was or what it was all about, even though he could see plainly that I myself was in the racket. He was just afraid of the old double cross, that's all, and kept the tightest of mouths. We played the roads only about 6 hours a day, bowling right through towns of every size and kind. At his orders, we passed up all hitchhikers, even such as poor old women walking with crutches. We never even turned the front wheels in at a tourist camp. When we weren't on the road, we camped in deep woods and thickets. He had more than plenty of grub packed in the old car, and it became equally plain within a few hours that he had been lying low in some hideout for at least a full 60 days or so, for he didn't know the least bit of news. In fact, he was exactly like myself, who'd been nearly 4 weeks on water, and several weeks before that with eye muscles that couldn't read print. We were like a couple of Rip Van Winkles and had to talk ancient moth-eaten news only. We'd been 2 days on the way when the only incident arose in which he ever got a bit suspicious of my good intentions. We were, in fact, somewhere in Arizona, sitting across a campfire we'd built far out on a lonely mesa, and the hunger came on me to write a letter to the girl I'd last parted with near the Frisco Wharfs, in care of a certain postal box in her city where, so she'd told me, she could receive mail I had, that spare sheet of birch cadwallader stationery, and that America 2-cent stamped envelope. When I'd got done writing the letter and addressing the envelope atop a flat rock propped on my knee, I read the letter over by the fire. It ran, "My darling girl, I trust that you're home and safe now, and that sometimes when you think of our adventure and love, was just a dream, you'll remember me as the real part of that dream. I need not say, Princess, that it's been hard to forget you. In fact, it's been quite impossible. I'm heading for New York, though not directly. But write me someday, my very dearest dear, say 3 months from the date of our debarkation date, care of General Delivery, NYC, where I'll pick it up, or arrange to have it picked up. All my love to the prettiest princess who ever failed to get into Grimm's Fairy Tales, Jerry. P.S. I hope you're not still feeling a bit hurt about that mysterious, squarish, tied-up package that I had amongst my luggage on the Ningwa. The reason, my dear, that I didn't show you its contents, nor ever tell you what they were, was because it held something that would have made you a bit squeamish, to say the least. Just a skull and a jawbone, brought from Honolulu, and to which considerable of a story attaches. Now you'll understand, I'm sure. I was about to insert the letter in the envelope when the big gray-eyed chap across from me spoke. And where, partner, were you expecting to mail that? Oh, at any Uncle Sam's mailbox along the road, maybe near some hot dog stand or something. Well, suppose you let your sidekick, Pro Tim, and tour conductor censor all mail going out on this cook's tour. You know damn well I'm taking it on the run, for you've bumped up against that 45 under my armpit enough times. Hey, hey, I expostulated amicably. You know damn well I'm no copper-hearted fink, willing to shove a right guy into a grab. So read to your heart's content. Want the envelope, too? No, he said, and friendly again after he'd perused the communication. I've been in love myself, and know the language. Seal her up then, brother, and post her tomorrow. And what say we roll into the old blankets now for an early start? And mail the letter I did next day, at one of Uncle Sam's roadside post offices, there in that state of Arizona. Heaven knows just where, but I estimated that, regardless of just where the box was, it would take just about 2 days for the missive to reach its postal lockbox destination. And since the princess, so she told me, went to that lockbox on Saturdays only, it would be in her own precious hands by the end of the week. And at last, on October 24th, about 9:30 p.m. on the undoubted outskirts of El Paso, my unknown acquaintance of the past 4 days drew up short, opened the door of his car, and nodded me out. "You're on the edge of LP now, old kid," he said, "for I know the town so-so, and you'd better scram on in by one of the shorts, because I'm going round by the Jefferson Belt Highway, and thanks a million. For the way I'm using the old mitt right now, I'll make where I'm going in 10 hours or so. For, of course, partner, it isn't and never was New Orleans." He paused genially. "And you'll forget, I take it, that you and I ever met?" "I sure will, old-timer," I promised, willingly enough. "My best to you, for I've been in a few hot spots myself. I'll even do more than forget you. I'll go so far as to forget the registration plate on the back of the car and the front one with it at that." He chuckled. "Oh, remember them all you mean, if you feel like it. Sure, they're duds, if you don't think I'd have left that sort of trail behind me, do you? So long, and good luck to the girl as well as yourself. I can't ask you to remember me to her when you meet her." And up the road he drove, his hands as good as new by this time. Some 200 yards or so ahead, I saw him get out of the car and unfasten the license plate at the back. And evidently, though I could not see what he was doing, he took the front one off, too. He put back what were evidently another pair of fake numbers, or they may have been the ones belonging to the car, for all I could tell. He waved to me genially, and then the darkness farther up swallowed him. I followed on with my squarish wrapped parcel in my bag, looking for a car line to take me into town. And now I was to be treated to a demonstration of luck, fate, providence, call it what you will, that altered all my way of living. For my late companion's car had scarcely vanished round a bend when I heard some sort of crash, and the sound of shots, quite a series of them. I pulled up short at first, but then curiosity overcame every other impulse, and I went on round the bend and saw the end of the car line I had been wanting. Saw more. The Buick was sideways to the road, almost, a sort of diagonal, with its nose still pointing the way my companion had been going. But it sagged down on the near side, and I knew that faulty front axle had gone at last. But that was not all, by any means. A streetcar stood just ahead of the broken-down Buick, and between the two and round the Buick were quite a dozen federal men, two of whom were lifting a body out from the Buick. And still I went on, though I knew now what had happened. Way back on our road, some police agent or other busybody had spotted the car and recognized its occupants, one of them at least, and had phoned on ahead the description of the car in which the wanted man would be found. It must have been some way back, too, for these federal men to get into position, and as I found out, to place the wire cable across the road from an electric-powered standard on one side to a tree on the other. They had so arranged it that the cable could be slacked off for legitimate traffic and tightened up to stretch about 2 feet high across the road when the car they wanted hove into sight. And I judged they had caught him and he had showed fight. Hence the body being lifted from the car. I felt a bit sick over it at first, for he had been decent to me. I had known all along he was in a jam, and most likely the description of the car had gone ahead of him, quite apart from the registration plates, and a watch had been out, especially on the last part of our run. Anyhow, they had got him. To this day, I do not know what he had done, or why they wanted him, but almost certainly it was murder. I had felt pretty sure of that from the first day, by his way of running the car. I would have turned back or hidden, but it was too late. I knew they had seen me, and I had to go on. A big chap stopped me, just short of the broken-down Buick and within a dozen yards of the streetcar I had hoped to ride into El Paso. But I faced up to it confidently, an altogether different being from the one who had crept aboard the Malola to make the run to Honolulu. Then I had been a pure down and out, liable to suspicion by the very look of my clothes. Now I had on the new suit I had brought for my trip with my princess, and looked like a prosperous bagman at the worst, and there was nothing incriminating about me. I carried no gun, and all my safecracking outfit was safely cased back in San Francisco, including that wonderful Courfeyrac cutter. For with the chance of a free ride here, I had not stopped to pick up the outfit after bidding the princess goodbye. "Hey, what are you?" the federal man demanded sharply. "Where do you come from?" "No, stop where you are. Nobody goes past here till we give the say-so, so don't you try any tricks. Now then, who are you?" "Henry Sharp, salesman in Structural Steelworks," I said. "Oh, yeah, is that so?" he retorted sarcastically. "Well then, Mr. Henry Sharp, what's a salesman in structural steelwork doing trampling along this road at this time of night, with all he's got in the world or somewhere about that in his two hands, eh? That ain't the way salesmen take the road, if I know anything about it." "You do, I guess," I said as easily as I could. "Anyhow, that's me, on my way to El Paso." And I made to pass him to the streetcar, which, however, showed no sign of pulling out on its way yet. "Oh, no, you don't," he barked, getting in front of me. "I want to know a hell of a lot more about Mr. Henry Sharp before he gets away to town. Where do you come from? Don't stop to think. Answer up." "From Hawaii," I answered, as calmly as before, if not more so. "I landed at Frisco and came on here, and yesterday my money gave out, all but enough to feed me for a day or two. So I've hoofed it." "In structural steelwork," he said, with a heavy sarcasm. "I was, but I wired in my resignation to Pittsburgh Restless Incorporated before I left Hawaii," I said, using the first name that came to mind. "They played it low down on me, and I knew a man of my abilities could make more than I'd ever see out of them, so I took a chance on it, and now I'm headed for El Paso, because the president of the Lake Structural," again I coined the name and hoped, "is due here day after tomorrow, and I'm carrying enough about his rivals to get me in with him if I talk the right stuff." "Huh, pretty thin," he grunted, Hand over that bag and let's see what stuff you've got. Come on. He waggled a gun suggestively. I put down my bag and he opened it and tumbled its contents out onto the road. He went through every item from shirt to toothbrush. Uh-huh, he grunted again at the end of his inspection. Nothing here that would be useful to the president of any company. He tried the sides and the bottom of the bag, but did not discover the empty false bottom. What you got in that bundle under your arm? A skull, I said frankly, because it was no use being anything but frank. I'm sending it off from here to Professor J. L. Hastman of Chicago. It's one I bought specially for him from Hawaii and said to be the skull of one of Kamehameha's wives herself. That was a side game of my trip there to get that skull. Hand it over. Let's see, he bade, and I complied. He took my package, untied, and opened it, and gave the skull the once-over. The twice-over, in fact. Then he pointed to the hole in it, and he gave me a long look of suspicion. Looks like Kamehameha's wife had trouble at the end of her career, he said. How do you account for this damage, huh? I don't, I told him, when a couple more of his sort came around to hear the dialogue. I wasn't there when it happened. If I'd had anything to do with making that hole, would I be such a fool as to tote the evidence around with me? Do I look like that sort of fathead? He twisted the skull all ways, turned it upside down, and shook it, but did not unfasten the bit of cord that held the jaw in place. I heard one of his fellow Federals chuckle as he handed it back to me. Go gently on that ancient dead, Freddy, this man remarked. If it wasn't so ancient, Freddy growled, I'd take this bird up on suspicion right here and now. Then get on with it, I interrupted him, guessing boldness my best and in fact my only card to play. Take me along, and when you've verified every word I've told you and every other word I'm going to tell you, you'll be a sick man after answering to unjustifiable molestation of Henry Sharp, going about his legitimate business. I'm not scared, for I've nothing to be scared about. Go right ahead. He had nothing on which to go ahead, as I knew. He looked at me, rewrapping the skull, disappointment in his eyes. Say, feller, he said. We got the word there was two men in that car there, not one. What about it now? There was one in it when it passed me, I told him. I held him for a lift into town, but he just drove on, took no notice. Quite sure you wasn't number two in the car, he asked sneeringly. If you think so, prove it, I retorted. Prove any damn thing you can, and I won't worry. I've told you all about me, and I'm willing to give you chapter and verse for all of it, where I stayed in Hawaii, how I landed in Frisco, and you can get a copy of the passenger list of the boat that brought me there, and check up on that, if it'll make you any happier. As for this skull, I'm at liberty to tote 40 skulls over all of the United States, as long as I'm not connected with wearing the scalps off of them, and every one can have 40 holes in it, as long as I didn't make them. Oh, brother, I'm foot sore and wanting my perch for the night, and by the look of things here, you've got all you came after, except the second man you say was in that car. He left it before it passed me, I tell you, for it held only one on his loan then. You're damn slick with your tongue, he said sulkily. And damn slick at backing up what it says, I fired back. Put me inside for the night, and I'll be saved the trouble of feeding myself. I held out my hands. Put a pair of bracelets on, so I'll give no trouble whatever, I offered, for I've all tomorrow to waste. The president of Lakes Structural doesn't get here till day after. The empty streetcar pulled out on its long run, and I saw another one coming along. Freddy shook his head gloomily, though obviously he had already had the main object of this federal holdup. Ah, get the hell out of it, he said. If there was one thing on, you hear? What about this dope you're going to hand the president of your Lake Structural? Where is it? Not in your baggage, I can see. No, sonny, I told him. It's packed where it's safe in that spot, which in your case is a mere vacuum. My brain. Don't think I'd trust financial facts like I hold a paper, because I wouldn't. What's your hangout here in El Paso? He asked next. By the question and the manner of it, I knew I had him beaten. He would have liked to hold me, but dared not take the risk, and if he had held me, I'd have won out. For not once in all the states is anything against me, and fortunately for me, my yeggman's kit was reposing utterly incommunicado in Frisco instead of being in my bag. Oh, brother, you sure are dumb, I mocked him. This is my first call in the good city of El Paso, and I'd have been bathing my sore feet in the bathroom of the handiest hotel if you hadn't been so damn officious. Since you're so kind, which hotel would you recommend? Ah, get to the hell out of this, he shouted at me. But I did not at once, for any hurry over getting away would have roused him to further suspicion, I knew. I took all the time there was, folding my shirts he had shaken out and repacking my bag, and let that second streetcar go without me. Meanwhile, he and his men abandoned all their interest in me and my belongings and took to getting the wrecked Buick off the road, while an ambulance came along to take the body of my recent friend into town. And to this day, I don't know why he was wanted. I boarded the third car that came and switched over to the go-back, and so rode into El Paso. A different man. Take that how you like, but I was different. Maybe that time on the old Ningwa had something to do with it. My princess had showed me what I ought to be, somehow, had restored me to belief in the possibility of sane and decent living, not preying on my fellow men as I had been doing for years now. Further to that, the way my acquaintance of the road had decanted me just in time seemed to show me that Providence had a use for me and was watching over me. For if I'd done that last half mile with him, all that was left of me would have gone to the El Paso mortuary, and the ambulance that took all there was left of him, while as it was I was a free man, clear of these federal guys, and with a competence or more due to me from Tillery Stevens as soon as I had found Laughing Sam and closed up the debit side of my account with the so-called mystery story writer. I was bound to win out, whatever I did. So I figured it after parting with that federal gang and riding a free man into El Paso. And right there, in the streetcar, I determined on a change. My kit, one of the best ever got together for the game I had been playing, could rust where it lay, for all of me. Even the Kufuriak, that beautiful tool, had to go with the rest, for I would never reclaim them. From that hour onward, safe-cracking would be a thing of the past, I determined. I would get even with Tillery, show him up for what he was, a dirty thief of other men's brains and property, and then run as justified my princess's belief in me. Be the man that she thought me. All that I reasoned out on the run to El Paso, and made myself the solemn promise of it, though I did not know, apart from Tillery Stevens, and what my plan against him might mean, how I was to live or what I was to do. But if Providence or fate or anything else were so far watching over me as to save me from the death that had come to my companion on the road almost instantly after he had dropped me, I concluded, it would go on handing me out mill tickets without my resorting to law-breaking. And that, as I say, was the end of my career as a yeggman. The car brought me into El Paso proper. I could not help but note that a National Guard encampment or something of the sort appeared to be going on, or even more likely, as I figured then, a military convention, for I no more tied up the signs about the town. The soldiers here and there, with that Pindiani bandit I'd read mentions of in California papers, weeks, even eras before, then I would credit the Chicago Tribune with decent newspaper tactics. A lithograph somewhere on a billboard advertised the Houston House as very reasonable. I had only about $5 left, and as my streetcar drew up in front of that very hostelry, the fates themselves seemed to prompt my going there. I went up to the desk. A big sign said, "Watch out for sneak thieves. Absolutely not responsible for valuables unless locked up in this safe. You have been warned." I had heard plenty, too, in my own racket of the slick gang of sneak thieves that covers all hotels and boarding houses in El Paso. A huge safe, apparently of metal, stood behind the reception desk. It had scores of locked drawers, like a Turkish bath, locked drawers of various sizes and shapes. If I had been within reaching distance of that beautiful crib instead of across a 10-foot moat of space, I might have known instanter that this one was of wood, cunningly puttied up where the wood was barked, and painted with two coats of actual metal paint. But not being in reaching distance, I fell for the glitter on the surface, and nodded towards a white, flat drawer when the clerk pointed his thumb interrogatively behind him. He drew out the lockbox I was indicating, and opening the grip sack atop the counter, I withdrew from it, and placed in that locked drawer, in turn, the manuscript of Grandfather's will, and all my letters from Sam, including that last illiterate note, typewritten in capitals, which Tillery had sent on to me. For all these, with the wrapped skull and jawbone and the stout package in my elbow, constituted not the case of Maryland versus William Lucullus, but of J. Hammond versus T. Stevens, Hifton McCarhort et alia, for something like $801,000, more or less. And upstairs to my small $2 room, I went with my lockbox key in my bag. I rested atop the bed a brief half hour, and then started forth on foot for the Negro district. A chap on the street directed me how to get there. I reached it finally. It was now about 10:30 p.m. A tall Negro with shirt made solely of ragged bandana was shuffling along. I stopped him. "Do you know Sam Davis, known as Laughing Sam from Alabama?" He scratched his head. "Yes, sir, like I's heard about him. I ain't been in here, I'll pass only a few couple of days." "I see," and I went on, and the next block I stopped a fat Negro with a coat crudely tailored from burlap, and repeated my question. "Do that man," he asked eagerly, "laugh and laugh and laugh and throw his head way back when he laugh?" "Yes, that's him. Where does he hang out?" "I don't know, 'cause I's from Memphis, and I knows the nigger up there from down around here somebots that laughed out away, and only he hisself laughing Bill from ober the hill." I left with a sigh, a bent dampened at the leads I seemed to be getting. The district was getting drearier now and tougher. In some fearfully down-at-heel block with low wooden houses all leaning awry and tumble-down steps leading to their thresholds, a Negro girl drew up to me under a low, rickety streetlight. She was about 27 years of age, so I judged, really pretty as such, though showing the beginning of the ravages of some kind of life she'd been living. Though her green silk dress was poor and threadbare, everything about her was neat. She was a comely wench, regardless of what she was. When she started to speak, I was certain she was going to solicit me. Instead, she said in a timid voice, "Can you kindly tell me, sir, whereabouts now is Nebley's Saloon and Chitterlin's Palace, what used to be here 7, 8, 9 years ago?" "God, no, girl," I said. "What do you want it for?" "'Cause a man what used to love me used to hang out there, and I wants to see him."
"You've been out of town, then?"
"Yes, sir. I dast come here tonight. I's been in New Orleans for 7 years.
"Well, that lets me out. But to tell you the truth, I wanted to ask you about a fellow of your race who hangs out in El Paso."
"How long, sir, you done hang out here?"
"Oh, off and on for years and years."
"Then maybe I can tell you something. I lived in this here district years ago and knowed most everybody in the color section what at that time wasn't gone nothing and nothing."
"Yeah, but that won't do me any good today. If you've been in New Orleans for 7 years, but anyway, the colored chap I'm looking for is named Sam Davis and is known as Laughing Sam from Alabama."
"My God," she said, her black eyes staring out of her face. Can you beat that? Well, that's why I's here in El Paso myself, to find Sam and to tell him after 7 long years that I loves him, and that I always will love him."